will continue with the afternoon session. We will begin with a series of brief talks from a good sampling of innovative responses to what we call the NID Challenge, Networking and Information Technology. First, I'd like you to welcome Henry Kelly from the Federation of American Scientists.
Thank you. I don't know if I dare tell Andy that somebody called him a czar. We'll never be able to live with it, but he's, but you know, he's a terrific guy. But what I'm going to be talking about here is a new legislative proposal, actually a new law. It sets up something called the National Center for Research and Advanced Information and Digital Technology. And actually, the origin of this goes back to NSF, probably 5 or 6 years ago, that funded a research roadmap trying to figure out how you would frame a research project in using information technology to advance learning. Very complicated, very deep subject. There was a lot of chaos in this field because the research is supported all over the place. You know, is it an education problem? Is it an IT problem? Is it a software problem? And through a whole series of workshops involving everybody from computer gamers to computer scientists to education people, they created a very elaborate set of research roadmaps that I'm going to talk about briefly. And convinced the group that participated that this was not only extremely important, but vastly underfunded, and that it ought to have a home. And that set of research problems led directly to the formation of this center. Now, the center was authorized as a part of the Higher Education Act, the reauthorization that went through just a month ago. It had very, very strong bipartisan support. The problem, of course, is money, and I'll get to that. This is authority, not appropriation. But the itch that was being scratched here, the thing that actually drove the strong consensus about this, was a very strong sense that IT tools were being used to increase productivity, to increase personalization everywhere in the economy except in education, and that there was just something broken, that there were the kinds of research investment you needed even just to pull the stuff out of commercial tools and into schooling just wasn't there. And this was really more of an applied research problem than a basic research problem. I think people felt at the end that NSF was doing a brilliant job at funding the fundamental research behind a lot of this, but there's sort of the application side of this that needed a separate entity, and that's what this was all about. So the idea of IT as being a way that everybody in the economy now uses to acquire information quickly in complicated bodies of knowledge in an efficient way, and to continuously improve the way you do this. So that it's not a series of isolated projects, but if you're trying to improve the way you're having your customers learn about your product, the way you're communicating with your workforce, there are a whole series. It sounds like I've stepped on a cat. I hope that's not me.
maybe our remote participants, could you mute your line, *6, please? Thank you.
So how does this work? Well, I'm going to start off telling you what I know to be true. And at some point, I will put up a flag and say I'm in the realm of rank speculation. So far, I'm on safe ground. In the bill, the purposes of this bill are very, very broadly defined. So it's R, D, D, and E on the whole portfolio of research challenges, trying to find ways of making learning more efficient. And you notice this is not restricted to any field of study. It's not restricted to any age group. People like to say this is prenatal to posthumous training, so that this covers the entire spectrum, and it gives the team that runs this the ability to immediately get out of any rigid trap of research management in this area, which can be a liability if you do it wrong. So the idea was you were going to do the applied research around structured problems. You're going to actually build and test stuff and learn and continuously improve and find out information that not only on what works, but to do a fairly refined piece of analysis that would actually help people understand what does work for whom and under what circumstances and how do you move it out to the people that need it. How is it going to be managed? NSF? Should it be in NIST? Should it be in the Department of Education? How do we avoid getting it absorbed and tramped into some monstrous bureaucracy that's not very interested in the subject? At the end of the day, after looking at a variety of alternatives, it was settled on the idea of making this an independent non-for-profit organization funded by the Department of Education. Now, there are a number of precedents for doing this in the research community. VA, NIH, other people have these that were usually started off to focus on a project, on a set of research problems that were kind of orphans within their own agency. Now, it's set up as a C3. It'll get federal money, but it can also receive money from other agencies, from any agency, and it can receive money from foundations or anybody that is able to contribute within a 501c3 not-for-profit charter. So it potentially provides you an opportunity to mix and match research funding from several different organizations, private and public. As I said before, it doesn't have any money. It's got a very interesting charter. The appropriations process this year is, I'm sure everybody knows, is even worse than it usually is, which is pretty hard to do, but it is, in fact, worse. It's at least 80% probability, I think, that you're going to get a giant continuing resolution for the rest of the year, and so there'll be nothing new started, including this. There's still a chance. There are a number of senators on the Appropriations Committee who think that they can do something this year, and we're, of course, encouraging them to keep trying. But one of the issues is at what level to start. $50 million is the number that they're requesting. Clearly, you want to ramp this up in a responsible way so that you're able to put together a good team and make sure you know what you're doing the first year. The idea is that you get, after the initial tranche of funding, you would put together a staff. First of all, pick a board, and one of the things I'd like to ask you at the end is the board is selected by asking the majority and minority leaders in the House and Senate to propose members of the board to the Secretary of Education, who will then appoint them. And so the members who actually put this through have asked for recommendations. So if you have ideas about people who would be able to manage, I'd be very, very happy to hear from you. There was an insistence that all the material available be released without restriction immediately. There was some concern that there'd be some places where that might make it harder for some company to actually come out with a product, and so under exceptional circumstances it can be waived. But the intent is to have everything in the open and public. So having said that, I will now have to leap into the realm of rampant speculation. The good news, as I said, is that this is the charter here is extremely broad, and it was intentionally so. And the idea was that this is really a new field. And one of the intriguing things is this is one of the very few new research organizations that's been set up in a long time. And one of the things we'd like to do before the money comes in is to take a very hard look at existing research management in the federal government and outside it to see what works, what doesn't work, how can you build the kind of interdisciplinary effort that you desperately need in this case. So that when you, if you do set up a new organization, you're not just repeating the mistakes of existing research management programs. This is a really, really tough problem because it does require you to mix so many different disciplines. And at least in my view, if you get captured by any one of them, you've lost the merits of this entire enterprise. So what kind of research is at least on the list? Well, I can tell you what came out of the NSF roadmaps and other, there are several of them that were put together. First of all, there's this idea that the way you approach instruction can be very, very different. Even the model of sitting in a classroom with somebody talking to you is radically different than being an apprentice going out trying to follow somebody through a field and build things and think about things and ask questions. So there are a lot of other approaches to pedagogy that are enabled by this. The blunt fact is that we really have a lot of wild speculation and wonderful books talking about the virtues of this, but precious little information about what actually works and what doesn't and for whom and under what circumstances. So you do have a lot of learning theory that has been done that talks about, at least in theory, how powerful these experiential learning environments can be. And they can be very personalized. You can, can answer people's questions immediately. You can adapt to individuals. You can let people practice things over and over again, try it work? This is what we need to know. And, you know, I've got a list here of some of the things that the learning theorists have been talking about, reflection, feedback, it's, you know, continuous assessment and so on. It certainly is possible that you can do all of these, but it is a radically different approach to pedagogy. One of the things that came out during the course of the past few years is that the people who develop computer games, commercial games, have instinctively actually addressed a lot of the problems that the learning scientists were talking about. How do you create an authentic, motivating task that you're willing to spend hundreds of hours solving a completely idiotic problem if you're motivated correctly and you're willing to learn all kinds of things? And there's one game where somebody had to, I think to win you had to learn 200 words of Klingon to win the game. But people will do this kind of thing if you get the motives right. It's personalized, so it moves you along in a race that's not too fast, you're not too slow, and so if the game is not continuously interesting, if you're not constantly just reaching for things slightly out of your grasp, it's a bad game and it won't sell. So these guys have instinctively done a lot of the things that the learning theory have thought about. And one of the interesting things about games is that you're being tested all the time. In fact, you don't mind being tested, and if you fail and the dragon kills you, you get up and try again or ask your text message your friend to figure out how to do it right. So the test is so subtly involved in this that it's not an oppression, it's a measure of your own skill. You're aware instinctively of what you know and what you don't know. So this ended up being a very intriguing part of the research plan to get the people who have sort of instinctively done this in commercial operations lined up with the learning theorists and people who've thought about this in a more formal way. Another big issue was inquiry management. This is something which is a huge amount of commercial investment. Customer has a question, how do I get it answered efficiently, tailored to them in a way that's timely? How do I know when to call in a real human being to answer the question, which is expensive? But, you know, can you develop something which reacts that in a way that's technically correct, that knows something about the person who's asking the question? And if you're asking a question of a commercial site, it's looking at the cookie on your computer, which knows this frightening amount about you. And also answers to some kind of theory about how should I answer this question. Maybe you answer the question by asking another question. But this is a very big, interesting field commercially that hasn't really been brought into the learning environment. Then there's the question of how do you measure the performance. And this is a very, very vexed issue. But we're so used to trying to teach the things you can measure using conventional testing tools, true-false tests or, you know, essays or something. But if the test of whether you can fly an airplane, if you get in the airplane, let me see you fly it, it's a kind of a different approach. Or the fish are all dying in the pond, why? Well, that's kind of closer to what a real scientist certainly or would like to see you be able to test. Can you actually do this kind of thing? Could those tests be kind of like the things that are built into the games where they're continuously part of the assignment, so by the time you get to the summative assessment, the final, you have no doubt in your mind that you're going to pass it because you know you're going to pass it. But it's a very different approach to assessment. Again, everything I'm saying here is rampant speculation. We know very, very little about what works and what doesn't. What we do know is that there are places that have had a lot of money in this for a long time that are really impressed, and it's mostly the U.S. military. And one of the things that they're finding is you can teach really complicated things really fast. And this shows there's a huge variation in the outcomes of this is, I believe, it's sailors trying to learn a software package. And most of them finished it in half the time that was required for the class. It used to be 8 weeks in a seat, whether you knew it or not. It turns out half the people, if they knew they could get out faster, learned it in half the time. Some of them learned it in 10% of the time. Some of them, it turns out, never got it at all, but that's another problem. But, no, but you know, if you say this is the distribution of the people sitting in your classroom and you're forced to keep everybody on the same schedule for 8 weeks, there's a problem. But DOD really has gotten religion on this. But at the end of the day, of course, one of the big research problems is, does this stuff, in fact, work? Does it accomplish what you want it to accomplish? And this evaluation question is deeply tied to that, because if what you want to know is, can you name the 14 parts of a fish? Then you have one set of evaluations, which is sort of typically what we do about that. But if you want to ask questions like, why don't fish sink? And, or, you know, can you fix this software that doesn't work? It's a very different kind of evaluation. And so one of the troubles is we don't really have tools often to measure what we want. And some of these IT phenomena. phenomena can actually measure very sophisticated skills, including things like group skills. Can you work in a team you've never worked with before? Can you deal with a physicist you learn when you never worked with a physicist before? Things of this sort. You can actually imagine testing. And again, DoD has spent a lot of time trying to tease out how do you distinguish between group performance, which you want to test, and the individual's contribution. You know, if it turns out one of the troubles with groups is often that Sally is doing all the work and everybody else is getting the credit. But can you tease that observation out of what you see in people working real time? Well, at least in principle. So that's at least a range of portfolio of things that are likely to be on the list. They were certainly on the NSF roadmapping list, which was used to brief the people that created the legislation. One of the interesting things that's come along recently is the observation that one of the troubles with educational software development is you tend to run a competitive procurement. You give somebody, a really, really smart person, a small amount of money. She builds this brilliant thing, tests it on 30 students, publishes a paper, and then it disappears. And even in an NSF, they've got a whole room full of stuff. They funded that they can't even play anymore because they won't work on the operating system. And, you know, and it doesn't interoperate with anything else, and it's painful. You know, you've learned something, but if you're in the commercial business, you couldn't conceivably do this. And certainly in the browser world, everything you develop, you're assuming that if you put something on the web, the next generation of browser is going to be able to read it. If the browser can't do that, it's probably not going to do very well. So is it possible to imagine that you could set up persistent, complicated simulations that would be building on themselves and that could persist and be upgraded and not have to go away? And that's actually the whole field of technology that has suddenly exploded on the world in the last few years that I think, at least in principle, can solve a lot of these problems. And what I'm showing here is just conceptually there are two kinds of use cases. One is building a world, which might be an environment or it might be an ancient city. You have lots of people contributing stuff. It has to be peer-reviewed. You want to make it open enough that lots of people contribute, but not so open that it's not reviewed by anyone. And then the second use case is you've got this beautiful simulated world. How do I use it? I might want to just give a tour. I might want to set up a game. I might want to design a test. I might have the same world, and there are four different ways of teaching biology in it, and you might have competitive approaches and let the students and the instructors give it four stars or no stars. You know. Anyway, there's a lot of opportunity here, and it's another whole dimension of educational software that isn't, that we really hadn't considered until recently, which is to say that the revolution here not only in how you teach, but how you build the stuff that you use to teach. But you can build this stuff collectively, share it, review it, rate it, and have it continuously improve in principle. So anyway, that's another research dimension that is certainly going to be on the table as this is put together. So at the end, this is all hat and no cattle, as they say in Texas. It's a great idea. Doesn't have any money. I think on the other hand, it has a really solid basis of political support at this point. We're quite happy with the breadth of support. We do have time. The community has time now, I think, to think hard about how you want to manage this, and also who you want to put on the board. Because if the board is a bunch of deadheads, where the whole thing is just, you know, it's designed to provide a kind of a political barrier between the bureaucrats and this research plan. Not to say that this team is going to have complete lack of accountability, but it was clearly designed to give the team enough rope to hang themselves at the committee, so that it'll be very, very crucial to get advice about how do you set this thing up in a way that really does produce the kind of creative research results we want, and that merits the investment and growth that I hope it's going to get in the next few years. So, thank you for inviting me. I'm quite honest about wanting advice about both who to put on this board and also advice about how to set how to manage the research and set priorities. So, thank you.
Do you have any quick questions for Dr. Kelly? Yes, go ahead.
I've heard it said that 70% of all learning is done in background mode, and the teachers get to work with the foreground 30%. If there was some research that actually showed what those numbers really are, and, for example, if you hook the front consciousness 30% with something like a little musical tune that we all know, and so they're focusing on that, that leaves the remaining 70% to be worked with, which is a lot bigger than the 30%. Is it possible to actually do this on a systematic and consistent basis?
Well, what we're hoping is that you can build, if we build some of these platforms, I keep on saying, well, whoever it is doing it is able to build some of these platforms, you'll have an experimental tool that you can use to test hypotheses in this. And one of the problems right now is that if you were to try to test that hypothesis, you spent a fortune building the software environment to test it and had nothing left over to actually run your experiment. I hope that if you do have a lot of these persistent environments, you can then set up a systematic way to explore exactly that kind of issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because in principle, you can gather data on thousands of people who are trying to solve the same problem simultaneously. And I know that some work has been done on the area. Again, the only places who have any data are people who have lots of money, and one of them are the people who teach surgery, particularly endoscopy. And again, the ratio is that 30% of what's happening, the surgeon is aware of. 70% is something that's happening in the deep background that he's not even aware of. But that 70%, when something goes wrong, she immediately says, "Ah, I got to stop the bleeding there." And that's where you want to ask, how many times have you done this surgery before they cut you open? Because if that 70% isn't there, then you're in trouble.
Is the expectation that the center would do most of its own research, or would it be funding out to external groups or organized? Would it be like a new DARPA for education, putting together external teams, or doing it mostly internal?
The legislation doesn't specify. When we were asked that question by the members, we strongly advocated a DARPA model, that you keep the team itself as small as you possibly could, and then let your people come in and form teams. But you'd like to be open on who those teams are. It's probably not, it's got to be highly multidisciplinary, and it's going to be mixtures of corporate and university and maybe, private labs. But it doesn't specify that. And that's part of the management analysis that needs to be done at the onset. I mean, my instinct is the DARPA model is by far the best. And I'd like to have, if there's a way to look at that model and compare it to others that may be equally valid, this is what we need to do in the next